Chapter 7, Self-Transformation. My first memory of experiencing awe was at 9 years old while standing in the dimly lit hall of the North American Forests exhibit at the Museum of Natural History in New York City. While my hands and forehead pushed up against the glass showcase of a diorama depicting the scale of humans in comparison to the great redwood and sequoia trees of California, I skeptically asked my mom if a place like that actually existed. When she said it did, I was wonderstruck with disbelief. But the people are so tiny and the trees are so big. Growing up in Brooklyn, my experience with the natural world was minimal, and my only point of reference for towering giants was the concrete skyscrapers of the city skyline. Even though I could hardly conceive of such untamed towers growing in the forest, I knew I had to see those majestic trees with my own eyes one day. And it was this experience that planted the first seeds within me to eventually leave New York and one day move out west. As I got older and the deadline for college applications quickly approached, I thought only of schools in California. From a relatively early age, I recognized I didn't completely gel with the ultra-urban culture of New York City, even though I was never 100% sure why. Intuitively, I just felt like the West would be a better fit. It represented a place where I could finally feel a sense of deep resonance, belonging, and even relaxation in my body. Part of me was starting to get a glimpse of the constant hypervigilance that my East Coast nervous system had grown accustomed to, and I was beginning to see little cracks in the calloused emotional armor that had allowed me to survive as a young girl growing up in the housing projects of Brooklyn. I also think some part of me knew that I would never escape the enmeshed dynamics of my family if I stayed put. However, despite my ardent desire to leave and start a new life in sunny California, the inescapable realities of poverty meant I was ultimately destined to pay in-state tuition at a New York State school. After graduating from college at 22, I reclaimed my intention to go west and decided to attend an alternative healing arts school in Northern California, the place where Dave and I would eventually meet. As I made my way across the country, I made sure my first stop on the West Coast was the old-growth forests of Northern California. As someone who had previously prided herself on never crying, I cried at the sheer beauty of nature's redwood cathedrals. Looking up hundreds of feet, I felt an even greater sense of awe than the little 9-year-old me had experienced in the museum that day. With my own eyes, I finally knew that trees of this magnitude were real, and it cracked me open. My body reverberated with an overwhelming reverence for the magnificence of life and the greater order of intelligence of nature. It was there and then that I first felt the power of an experience that I had previously only heard associated with church. A new version of myself had emerged. In the years to follow, I continued to be astonished by the vast differences between East and West Coast culture in the United States. In California and later in Colorado, the pace of life was slower and more manageable. The physical environment was beautifully distinct, and people talked about things like relating to each other from the heart, mindful listening, and even mindful eating. There was also easy and abundant access to incredible nature, health food stores, and any kind of dance, yoga, or alternative medicine modalities you can conceive of. It was the first time in my life where I was meeting people who were genuinely open-minded and prioritized their physical, emotional, and mental health in a sincere way, not merely for aesthetics. It was there, living and breathing in a totally different culture, that I could really see how just unhappy, shut down, and guarded I had been in my native New York. I realized that who I was there had been more of a reaction to my environment and a performance of what I thought I was supposed to be, rather than an authentic expression of who I was. The unbounded expansiveness of the West Coast paradigm naturally invited more of me to come forward, and I experienced parts of myself that I never would have known without leaving Brooklyn. The powerful magnetism of those first images in the museum called me to the West, and it was only there, in a place so different from where I came from, that I could actually see all the ways I had been conditioned by my environment to be out of sync with myself. Similarly, for some people, it is not until they have quote-unquote moved away from and sidestepped outside of monogamy that they start to see new and different parts of themselves come alive. The different worldview and beliefs of non-monogamy, paired with the new experiences that occur through having multiple relationships, can wake people up to newer versions of themselves that were either previously unavailable or only partially accessible. What I have observed over and over again is that the transition from monogamy to non-monogamy is not just a transformation of people's relationships. It can also catalyze a genuine awakening of the self. When people describe this experience to me, they talk about how living in a new paradigm activates, stimulates, and rouses new and old parts of themselves, leaving them feeling fortified and enlivened, finally in connection with their true or authentic self. I categorize this aspect of the transition from monogamy to non-monogamy as being a more expansive awakening of the self aspect that can give people a new sense of clarity, meaning, and purpose in their life. Moreover, as the contrast between the newer non-monogamous experiences and previous monogamous ways of being become more obvious to us, we are faced with all the ways we have potentially been inauthentic, disconnected, or even in denial about who we are and what we have really wanted for ourselves and in our relationships. These reflections about ourselves can call our sense of identity into question and open up new levels of uncertainty. Also, if we explore the many subcultures that make up the tapestry of the different non-monogamous communities, we may be exposed to additional concepts, lifestyles, and identities, which can further challenge our previous sense of who and how we are in this world. One of the consequences of this unique deconstruction of the self that can happen as a result of embracing non-monogamy is the realization that you may have previously been living a life that was never really your own. And this can evoke intense feelings of grief, shame, or guilt. In my experience, very few people are prepared for this kind of dismantling of their identity. Awakening of the self. As I listened to people I interviewed for this book and heard my clients' stories about how their sense of self was shaken or even radically jolted in either their initial transition to non-monogamy or in certain CNM transitions, they continually alluded to the concept of awakening to describe their own experiences. They used various metaphors to describe a process of going from a sleeping state to an awakened one, being reborn, experiencing the activation of their previously dormant authentic self, having a veil removed from their eyes, being a hermit crab leaving behind its shell, and even being toothpaste that can no longer be put back in the tube. As one interviewee said, quote, "It's the classic, once I was blind, but now I can see experience." Of course, the narrative therapist in me was fascinated by their repeated use of these analogies to describe what to them was a remaking of who they once were into a new self. After hearing several anecdotes of this kind, I was reminded of the consciousness-altering process described by Robert Keegan in his theory of adult development. where he outlines the transitions that individuals go through as they progress from one stage of psychological development to another. Robert Keegan is an American developmental psychologist and researcher who enumerated 5 stages of human psychological development. Like all models, theories of human psychological development can offer important insights and create interesting frames of reference for better understanding our behavior and ways of relating. However, they can also have significant limits and drawbacks. For example, many developmental theorists have been rightfully critiqued for being gender biased, equating higher levels of psychological development with more masculine qualities and lower stages of development with more feminine qualities. Another concern is a pronounced bias towards a Eurocentric or capitalist point of view in many of the theories, where attributes like freedom, individuality, and personal autonomy are touted as hallmarks of the highest developmental stages, whereas the values of more collectivist and sociocentric cultures, such as many in Africa, Asia, or Middle East, are seen as reflecting lower stages. Compared to other developmentalists, I have found Keegan to acknowledge that stages are influenced by the culture and history from which they arose and may not be applicable to all cultures throughout time. Keegan's theory has also tended to stay away from making binary claims rooted in gendered viewpoints, and his final stage of development includes qualities typically associated with both masculine and feminine archetypes, as well as individualistic and collective values. I chose Keegan's theory because it complemented the way my clients and interviewees described their personal growth experiences. And my intention is to offer his model as a useful way of framing the way we interact with the world, which to me is culturally and contextually dependent, and by no means absolute. See the accompanying PDF, which outlines Keegan's stages of development. According to Keegan, adults, just like children, go through different stages of psychological development, and these sometimes do not correspond directly to our biological growth. These stages, in and of themselves, constitute whole new paradigms, entire worldviews, and novel ways of mentally constructing our lived reality. For Keegan, becoming an adult is not just about learning new things, gaining more skills, or acquiring more knowledge. Instead of simply adding things to the container of the mind, he suggests maturity is more about changing the actual form of our container, changing the way we know and understand the world. This means there are vast qualitative and perceptual differences between the various stages that make it extremely difficult for individuals inhabiting different stages to really get each other. Also, because the transition between each developmental stage represents such a big change in our fundamental way of understanding the world, the process of going from one to the other can be expansive and illuminating, tumultuous and turbulent, or somewhere in between. As we progress through the developmental stages, we alternate back and forth between a more internal or individualistic focus and an emphasis on being more external and collectively oriented. Keegan was clear that people who occupy the later stages of the model are in no way superior or more advanced than people in earlier stages. He asserted instead that the process of moving through the developmental stages meant that we experience a significant increase in our own psychological complexity. And this allows us to reflect on ourselves and the world with new, expanded intellectual awarenesses and emotional capacities. As we increase our capacity to think and analyze in more complex and multidimensional ways, we gain more agency to deliberately choose the kind of relational realities we want. I find that Keegan's model is most useful to the degree that it gives us greater insight into our own lived experiences and helps us imagine new possibilities for our relationships. Instead of suggesting fixed or rigid levels of development, I see these stages as frames of reference that can help contextualize the often bewildering array of possibilities within CNM. As we consider the varying stages of Keegan's model, our intention is not to pigeonhole or diagnose the essence of a person's character or personality by associating their attitudes or behavior with a particular stage. The stages should not be weaponized or used as a means for categorizing, labeling, pathologizing, essentializing, dismissing, or diminishing ourselves or our partners. Reflecting on the testimony of my clients, I was able to track their different experiences and thought processes and link their expression to the corresponding stages of Keegan's model. While there were clearly individuals whose process indicated they were in the transition from stage 2, imperial mind, to stage 3, socialized mind, as well as people moving from stage 4, self-authoring mind, to stage 5, self-transforming mind, the majority of personal anecdotes reflected the transition from stage 3, socialized mind, to stage 4, self-authoring mind. Because the first stage, the impulsive mind, represents the stage occupied by children and was not representative of any of my clients' or interviewees' descriptions of their experience, I will only focus on stages 2 through 5 in this chapter. Another important consideration is that these stages do not represent static states of being that are achieved once and for all. It's actually possible to display the characteristics of certain stages in certain circumstances, or in particular relationships, and not in others. For instance, as an adult, when you spend time with your family of origin or go home for the holidays, you might find yourself taking on aspects of the adolescent imperial mind typical to stage 2. While in your work or with a trusted friend or partner, you could present more as the self-authoring mind of stage 4. The important thing is to be able to track and recognize your own process and the way of being in your intimate relationships in order to decide on which stage you want to be functioning in. Stage 2, the imperial mind. Stage 2, the imperial mind, is mostly associated with adolescence. The description of this stage is not meant to pathologize or reduce all teenagers into the superficial or pejorative stereotypes commonly promoted by North American culture, which suggests that they are completely narcissistic or selfish. Obviously, teenagers are complex, multifaceted, and capable of a wide range of behaviors and traits, many of which include thoughtfulness, sincerity, empathy, and altruism. However, from a strictly developmental point of view, I do think it is appropriate to make some generalizations about the evolutive impetus driving this stage of human psychological development. In North America, one of the primary functions of adolescence is to begin defining and asserting our own individuality and identity as distinct from our family systems of origin. This drive to figure out who we really are in a larger social context creates a necessary me-focused orientation. Granted, when this self-first perspective is not tempered by appropriate role models, it can be taken to extremes. It can become shadowy and self-serving in ways that are potentially destructive. But in its essence, the need to focus primarily on oneself during this phase is a critical step in the process of figuring out who one is and where one fits in their particular social reality. Regardless of their age, some adults remain squarely rooted in this psychological stage, In stage two, the primary emphasis is on one's own needs, interests, and agendas. It is very individualistic, and relationships with others are mostly valued in terms of their utility, the advantages that can be gained by maintaining them. Relationships are therefore more a means to an end than an end in and of themselves. The transactional quality of stage two relationships means it can be difficult for individuals to have a real sense of shared reality with a partner. They are more preoccupied with what they are getting and how others perceive them than with how their partners actually feel. And this preoccupation is typically concerned with the possible consequences that other people's perceptions of them could have on their own experience. For example, a person occupying stage two would avoid lying to a friend, not because honesty and transparency are important in and of themselves, but rather out of fear of the consequences of lying or of the possible retaliation. The core values of the stage two consciousness are personal comfort, convenience, reputation, self-satisfaction, and unfettered freedom. Furthermore, stage two individuals may follow rules, express allegiance to certain principles or ideologies, and even act in accord with the policy and protocol, but they will only do so to be liked, rewarded, or avoid being punished. If they are faithful in a romantic relationship, for instance, their loyalty comes from fear of being caught by their partner, not because cheating goes against their personal values. As one woman in this stage said to her husband, quote, "It's fine if you cheat on me, but just don't leave me," unquote. Stage three, the socialized mind. In stage three, the socialized mind, our focus shifts outward to others, and we no longer view relationships as simply a means to an end. We can consider other people's opinions and perspectives, not just because of the potential consequences of those opinions, but because we are open to and care about other points of view. However, despite our capacity to take other people's thoughts and feelings into consideration, it is the ideas, beliefs, and norms of the systems around us, family, culture, institutions, and society, that most influence our behavior and make up the center of our moral and ethical compass. Our point of reference for making decisions and judging the value of our actions is the conditions and expectations of our external social environment. Statistically, most adults stay at this stage. Part of the challenge of this stage is that we lack the connection to a strong, independent sense of self, apart from the larger systems we are embedded in. The need to conform to these external standards makes it difficult to recognize and embrace the aspects of ourselves that challenge the status quo. As a consequence, when faced with conflict, we can have a hard time connecting with and asserting any of our wants and needs that run counter to social norms, and they can actually hide, deny, repress, and even criticize the parts of us that seem socially unacceptable, if we're even aware of them. Because people at this stage derive their sense of self from external validation, their need for approval is very high, and they tend to spend a lot of effort projecting the image of themselves that others are expecting to see. Stage four, the self-authoring mind. The transition into stage four, the self-authoring mind, represents the next developmental shift from unquestioning conformity to social rules and norms to taking responsibility for creating one's own life and reality. External sources of authority are dethroned and replaced with internal sources as we take on the task of authoring the stories that shape our experience. While we can clearly recognize and acknowledge that we still belong to a particular culture that impacts us, we have an inner compass that allows us to critically evaluate its beliefs and discourses, and we can decide for ourselves their value or relevance in our lives. As we prioritize our own opinions and viewpoints, we have more agency to change and influence our life according to what's true for us, and we can let go of the ideas from our culture, religion, or parents that have held us back. At this stage, the question is no longer who should you be, but rather who do you want to be? Our aim is not to please others, but to live out our values and author a unique personal sense of purpose. At this stage of development, we can objectively evaluate the conditions of our social environment and choose to either move with or against the stream of collective consciousness. The freedom to live in alignment with our own thoughts, feelings, and values is a liberating experience for most, which is often described as a personal awakening. As a socialized mind from the previous stage, showing who we really are is risky. A significant disadvantage of this weariness is that because we never feel comfortable or safe showing who we are, we can never fully trust the love we receive from others. This is because the love we receive is meant for the socially acceptable projection we present to the world, and not the complex, dynamic selves of our lived experience. And thus, it could be partial. Therefore, to be fully loved for who we are, we must first know who we are, and then be able to express that self-authored self to others. Stage 5, the self-transforming mind. In stage 5, the self-transforming mind, the ability to consciously write the story of our lives through the self-authoring process of stage 4, takes the next leap forward. With the burgeoning capacity to simultaneously embrace our individuality as well as our relational and collective realities. Now we realize we are not tied to any particular identity or role, even the ones we create for ourselves. And we wake up to the possibility of consciously recreating ourselves in the context of new relationships and life experiences. This stage reflects elements of the Buddhist concept of the impermanence of self, a self that is not inherently fixed or static, but in constant flux in response to the circumstances of the moment. As we come to realize that all identities are relative to some social context and therefore socially constructed, we lose our attachment to any particular narrative or role and instead pick and choose whatever resonates with the circumstances in which we find ourselves. We are no longer confined to the restrictions of any one particular identity. We can see and hold the complexities of life, recognize that all identity constructs are limited, and continuously pivot to meet the needs of the current situation. From the freedom and autonomy of the self-transforming mind, we can question external authority and ourselves, scrutinizing our own thoughts and beliefs as well as those of any system we're a part of. We do not believe that truth can be contained or expressed by any particular point of view or strategy. We intentionally choose the filters through which we evaluate the information coming to us from others. And we are open to change ourselves to developing new filters as necessary or desired. We are comfortable holding multiple, even conflicting thoughts, emotions, identities, and ideologies at once. And we can understand things from various perspectives. Thanks to this perceptual agility, we are able to embrace paradoxes that would seem impossible from earlier stage of development. The number of individuals who transition to this stage is relatively small in comparison to the previous stages. Applying Keegan stages to non-monogamy. See Table 7.2, Applying Stages 2 through 5 of Keegan's Developmental Stages to Monogamy and Non-Monogamy. The Table 7.2 gives us a look at the 4 stages of Keegan's developmental model that we have been exploring thus far, filtered through both a monogamous and non-monogamous lens. The statements associated with each stage are reflective of the perspective of someone occupying that particular stage of development. Even though Keegan's five-stage model of adult psychological development was never specifically intended to be applied to non-monogamous relationships, I find it incredibly useful for mapping out the different places where people are on their CNM journey. Recognizing and understanding motives and values that characterize each stage can support a better understanding of our own behavior and that of our partners. And it also gives us a roadmap for the possibilities that lie ahead. When we can see our actions and feelings as the expressions of a series of stages that can change over time, we have the opportunity to not only make more sense of our relational challenges as we journey through a non-monogamous paradigm, but also be much more engaged in our own personal development. This model helps explain why, even though two people may be practicing the same CNM style, it can look very different depending on which developmental stage someone is in. And just because someone is CNM doesn't mean that they are living it through the same values, awareness, capacities, and perspectives. Another reason Keegan's model is so useful is because it can help us map out the different places where individuals start their journey in CNM. As people begin to make the shift into CNM, they don't necessarily make a direct horizontal move from their monogamous stage of development to the corresponding stage in non-monogamy. For example, it is quite common for people who have entered the stage of self-authoring in a monogamous paradigm to actually fall back into earlier stages as they start to experiment with non-monogamy. The integration of consciousness that allows someone to move from one stage of development to another within a particular paradigm often does not translate across paradigms. This is especially true when the paradigm in question are significantly different in terms of their inherent complexity and dynamicism. For instance, the difference between the monogamous and non-monogamous paradigms can be so stark that the self-awareness and emotional intelligence garnered through monogamous relationships is often insufficient to successfully navigate the inevitable challenges that arise in non-monogamous ones. This means that as people make the transition to CNM, they are often quickly confronted with the realization that they need to expand their relational intelligence in order to meet the demands of the new paradigm. I see this discrepancy between the stages across paradigmatic lines as an unanticipated and shocking CNM surprise, especially when you see your partner suddenly acting like a teenager, becoming more self-focused, or deferring to authorities in ways you've never seen before. Having Keegan's model to put some of that paradigm shock into perspective can be incredibly supportive. In order to better understand why the developmental stages of Keegan's model do not always cross over cleanly from the monogamous to the non-monogamous paradigm, let's take a look at each stage and explore how the experiences and narratives of individuals can change as they make the paradigm shift. Imperial mind. When someone makes a purely lateral shift from the monogamous imperial mind to the non-monogamous imperial mind, their behavior is relatively easy to understand. The more self-focused mindset simply does what it has always done, focusing exclusively on itself and its own needs. It is simply the case that in non-monogamy, there are more people in the equation to get caught in the crossfire of a consciousness that cannot fully see the impact of its behaviors on others. The motivations underlying the imperial mind's behavior are relatively simple. Its main pejorative is to avoid negative consequences. For example, I don't cheat because I don't want to get caught, or more specifically, I don't want the hassle of the consequences of being caught. Similarly, someone in this stage could think, well, if I do cheat, it's because I know I can't get caught and likely won't get caught. I will say I'm following our CNM agreements, but sometimes I don't. Or I try to get by on a technicality. Or I do really care about you, but my freedom comes first. However, where things really become interesting is when someone from a later stage of development makes the shift to non-monogamy, and then all of a sudden they start to exhibit the traits of the imperial mind. This can be one of the most jarring and difficult transitions to manage for partners going through a CNM transition together. It can also be a huge disappointment when dating someone who initially presents as if they are a very conscious, mature CNM partner, but is later discovered to only be cloaking their self-centered and immature behavior in the name of CNM-friendly principles like freedom and autonomy. When someone takes on the behavior and posture typically associated with the imperial stage, it looks very much like what we'd expect from the shadow of adolescence, a sense of entitlement to do whatever you want, whenever you want, regardless of the impact on your partners. From this place, there can be a strong urge to approach CNM like a free-for-all or open buffet, striving to have as many encounters with new people as you possibly can. You become hyper-focused on your desires and freedoms, and you essentially function like a single person with no commitments or accountability to anyone. You may feel bad that your partners are hurting or unhappy with your behaviors, but it doesn't necessarily stop you. Any attempt to rein in your enthusiasm, acknowledge the impact of your behavior, or slow your pace is met with your defensiveness and interpreted as manipulative or controlling, similar to a teenager pushing back against their parents' restrictions. In cases such as this, you may be proclaiming yourself to be ethically non-monogamous, but you are actually using your non-monogamy unethically as a way to absolve yourself of responsibility, care, or consideration for others. Unfortunately, this is the kind of behavior that is often associated with CNM, which leads to the justification of some very skewed and negative stereotypes. However, it's not truly reflective of non-monogamy per se, but rather of the stage of psychological development of the person who is engaging in CNM. And yet, despite all the potential pitfalls of this stage, this can actually be a very important, necessary, even healthy phase for some people to go through. The trick is learning how to give this part of ourselves the freedom to explore and satisfy its needs while balancing that exploration with a grounded relational awareness of our partners. What really makes the imperial mind stage an important stepping stone in the personal journey of so many people transitioning to CNM is the fact that it provides a powerful counterpoint to several of the imbalances that frequently exist in monogamous relationships. For many, living in accord with the rules of society often means we must fragment ourselves, suppressing or denying certain needs and wants. In particular, we often find ourselves in relationships where the expectations of our mononormative culture say we should put the needs of our spouse, kids, community, family of origin, and even our work above our own. To do otherwise would simply be selfish. Because of this, many people never even had the opportunity to go through the imperial mind stage, and thus never developed the strong sense of me that could stand its ground and advocate for itself. By skipping or only partially making it through the imperial stage, they potentially entered into the subsequent stages with several pieces of their psychological development still unintegrated. Then, as they later transition into CNM, the allure of the freedom promised by open relating unleashes a flood of pent-up energy as the frustrated martyr, overworked caregiver, obliging spouse, or exhausted parent realizes, possibly for the first time in their lives, that their needs matter too. They are emboldened by the idea that they too have the right to do what they want as a person and can at least shed the oppressive shackles of the socialized self. The problem is then that this rush of newfound personal freedom swings too far. The desperate feeling of living years, possibly decades, under the yoke of self-denial creates a blinding desire to make up for lost time, which in the end distorts our perception and eclipses our relational awareness. We get lost in our pursuit of fulfilling long-standing desires at the expense of our relationships. Socialized mind. Whether in monogamous or non-monogamous relationships, people anchored in the stage of the socialized mind are primarily identified with the values and norms set forth by the social systems to which they belong. Right and wrong are determined by external sources of authority rather than one's own personal experiences, and obeying the dictates of the community is the main concern. If you are monogamous, then being exclusive is what is considered right, and so you strive to be faithful. From the socialized perspective, cheating is morally wrong and a breach of the commitment to be loyal. If someone in this stage does cheat, they will feel a tremendous amount of guilt and shame about it, and they may even consider themselves a lesser person for doing so. Monogamous individuals at the socialized stage can struggle with their desire for sex or love with more than one person and experience a lot of internal turmoil around the discrepancy between their personal desires and the dominant social expectations. However, despite the inner tension caused by this discrepancy, these individuals will affirm the rightness or legitimacy of the monogamous narrative while dismissing their own wants or needs. On the other hand, people at the socialized stage who have made the transition into non-monogamy are liberated from that particular moral dilemma. But while they can enjoy the freedom of their non-monogamous experiences, they are nevertheless subject to the standards, norms, and expectations of whatever CNM subculture they are operating in. Within the CNM paradigm, there are various subcultures, each with its own particular ideas about what to do and not to do. For example, within some non-monogamous communities, the idea of having prescriptively hierarchical relationships is absolutely counter to the philosophical tenets of CNM. And non-hierarchical relationships or relationship anarchy are considered more favorable models of human relating. Whereas other CNM styles assume or prefer couple-centric, prescriptively hierarchical relationships. As the socialized mind encounters these kinds of extreme positions, it can struggle with thinking critically about the relevance of them for its own experience and simply take them on as its own. The tendency to defer to what non-monogamous quote-unquote experts will say will override their own thoughts and opinions, and they will still conform to the ideas of others. Another challenge that the socialized person can often face in non-monogamy is the overwhelm that can come from trying to please not just one partner, but multiple partners all at the same time. Since people at this stage often have difficulty knowing themselves and staying grounded in their own needs and wants, they often fall into the trap of taking on the responsibility of juggling the needs of everyone else. Instead of being able to assert their own boundaries and preferences, they quickly yield to their partner's rules and expectations, which can eventually become unsustainable. When conflict arises in their relationships, these people can often take on negative identity labels, struggling with feelings of unworthiness or a sense of not being good at CNM. They interpret the bumps in the road as signs that they are somehow failing to live up to the standards of their relationships or their community. Chapter 7, Continued. Self-authoring mind. Entering the stage of the self-authoring mind represents a significant transition in individual consciousness. We have left behind the self-centeredness of the imperial stage and are no longer bound to the dictates of social constructs as we were in the socialized stage. We are ready to claim the freedom and responsibility of deciding for ourselves who and how we want to be in the world, making our decision based on what feels most in alignment with our own lived experience. Because we have embraced the personal autonomy and power implicit in this stage, we are open to entirely new realms of possibilities that were previously unimaginable from earlier stages of development. It's an exciting and dynamic transition, filled with new learning and sometimes radical changes. From the vantage point of the self-authoring mind, I would suggest that practiced monogamy is no longer the default monogamy that most people ascribe to, but rather a conscious exclusivity that reflects the actual needs and wants of the people who choose it. This kind of monogamy represents an upgrade from the traditional monogamy that most couples engage in and can be quite expansive, even revolutionary for some people. Someone in the self-authoring stage can deconstruct mainstream monogamy and its limiting beliefs and intentionally sift through what works for them, leaving behind what doesn't. For instance, they might recognize how monogamy has traditionally aided patriarchal control of women, their bodies, and their sexuality, and so instead create a partnership that is more egalitarian, where the domestic, financial, and parenting responsibilities are more equally shared, regardless of genitals or gender. Partners at this stage who choose to be exclusive may decide to sleep in separate bedrooms, craft a commitment ceremony that best expresses their unique union, or decide not to get legally married, or even to live together at all. They may also still choose to have elements of traditional monogamy in their relationship, but to them, this is a conscious choice as opposed to conformity with an external standard. For the people who have integrated the self-authoring stage into their exploration of CNM, the experience is most often described as nothing less than an awakening of the self. They report new and emergent identities capable of holding more love, joy, pleasure, and even heartache. As they open up their relationships, they commonly note a parallel awakening of their sexuality, which for some releases decades of sexual repression. For some people, the introduction of things like kink, BDSM, or bisexuality inspires new erotic desires and preferences that offer previously unimagined horizons for sexual exploration. For others, the transition grants them the permission, possibly for the first time in their lives, to simply be a sexual being with their own unique wants and desires. However, reaching this kind of awakening in the context of CNM usually takes time, experience, and typically a lot of mistakes. Unfortunately, we don't arrive there instantly. And as previously stated, the fact that you have entered the stage of self-authoring in your monogamous relationship doesn't always mean you will begin your CNM journey with that as your starting point. Another potential downside of this stage is that we become over-identified with a certain style of CNM. In the expansiveness of our newly awakened self, we can quickly become attached to a particular form of CNM and start to think, this is who I am now. Choosing to embrace something like solo polyamory or open marriage may be an accurate reflection of our personal journey at the moment, and thus a valid expression of self-authoring. But if we cling to the constructs of a particular style or form of non-monogamy, we can fall into the trap of becoming too rigid or inflexible. Self-transforming mind. For people in the stage of the self-transforming mind, the need for structures, labels, and identities holds less sway. Here, the constructs of monogamy and non-monogamy may have little importance in and of themselves and merely serve as symbolic points of reference. Choice is the hallmark of this stage, and people in this stage can demonstrate a tremendous amount of relational responsiveness and flexibility. From the self-transforming mind, we can recognize all relationship structures as relative and so appreciate their strengths and weaknesses. We can appreciate the benefits of monogamy as well as acknowledge its limitations. And we can enjoy the many advantages of non-monogamy without assuming we will be in non-monogamous relationships for the rest of our lives. The self-awakening that begins in the self-authoring stage expands to encompass a sense of self that can identify with something bigger than itself. In this stage, the stage of self-transformation gives us an expanded capacity to identify with the whole of the human community. We can hold the complexity of being both an individual with our own particular needs and wants and an inseparable part of the social collective in which we find ourselves without tension or contradiction. This ability to fluidly go back and forth between a personal and social consciousness gives us a perceptual flexibility that allows us to pick and choose the ideas with which we create our sense of self. Since we no longer feel a sense of obligation to ideology, dogmas, or constructs, we have a tremendous amount of freedom to create our relationships according to the values and principles with which we most resonate. In this sense, the stage of self-transformation is like a spiritual awakening, where the possibility of a love unencumbered by artificial constructs becomes the very thing we are awakening to. Our relationships become vehicles for more than just the satisfaction of our personal needs or the fulfillment of social expectations. They are the unfettered expression of our capacity to love with our whole being. They serve the purpose of increasing our capacity to love in ways that are not hampered by the social programming that previously dictated our relational choices. Through the self-transforming lens, CNM could be seen as a path to states of consciousness where love is given and received without clinging to structures or outcomes, or conversely, that exclusive commitment can feel expansive and inspires devotion when it is no longer encumbered by monogamous obligation. In the ebb and flow of multiple relationships, one might learn how to allow connections to be defined by the uniqueness of the individuals coming together and what is best for that particular combination of human beings, eventually arriving at a place where one can truly love others for who they really are and not just for the needs they satisfy. We can also appreciate that love does not always conform to our ideas about it, and that its nature is to change and evolve over time. This allows us to keep letting go of the urge to control our relationships and to surrender to the natural rhythms of love, which include inevitable phases of more or less connection and disconnection. It should be noted, however, that none of the aforementioned description of the self-transforming mind is meant to negate the importance of intentionally cultivating emotional safety and security in CNM relationships. We do not mean to suggest that people occupying the self-transforming stage operate with a disregard for the attachment-based needs of their partners. If anything, the deepened ability to attune to their own needs and wants that comes with the self-transforming stage will actually enhance our capacity to tune into our partners as well. Without the influence of the limiting beliefs or ideas that come to us from society about who or what we and our partners or relationships are supposed to be, or what needs and wants are reasonable and legitimate, we are much more likely to create relationships that genuinely suit the needs of everyone involved. The interaction of the stages. In Chapter 5, we discussed Bader and Pearson's developmental model of couples therapy to better understand the various stages relationships can go through. Specifically, we saw that differentiation is a natural step in adult relationships. As we applied that model to CNM, we were able to see some of the challenges partners face when they occupy different stages at the same time. For example, when one person wants to create more differentiation while the other continues to crave the comfort of symbiosis. In the same way that a mismatch in stages between partners can create problems in terms of differentiation, so too can a disparity between partners' levels of development within Keegan's model test a relationship. This potential for incongruity is even more likely when we remember that as people go from monogamy to non-monogamy, they can revert back to earlier stages of development. For instance, it's possible for monogamous partners to begin with both of them squarely rooted in the self-authoring mind. But in their transition to non-monogamy, for one partner to maintain their position within that stage while the other reverts back to the imperial mind. These kinds of divergent experiences make an already challenging transition even more difficult and can leave people feeling like they don't know who their partners are anymore. People can also have the experience that their different relationships function in different stages of development. Because relationships with various partners can be so different, it's not uncommon to find oneself in one stage with a particular partner and a totally distinct stage with another. The relationship we create with each partner, and thus the particular stage of the relationship as a whole, reflects the unique constellation of our personalities, life circumstances, and experiences. One client of mine observed that in the context of his domestic life with his nesting partner and their two children, he felt expected to play a more traditional and socially defined role. And so he experienced himself squarely grounded in the developmental stage of the socialized mind. But with his non-nesting partner, where there wasn't the same rigidly defined relational structure or expectations, he identified more with the self-transforming mind. While he appreciated feeling the different developmental facets of himself expressed through the different relationships, his nesting partner often complained of justice jealousy. Seeing him show up in new and expansive ways with his non-nesting partner, while remaining contained and reserved with her and their family, created hurt and resentment. In this particular case, our work was to deliberately connect with the desirable attributes of the self-transforming stage that he experienced with his non-nesting partner and begin to integrate them into the context where he was used to residing in a more socialized self. Recognizing that he could connect to this more enlivened side of himself and intentionally bring elements of it to the relationship with his nesting partner was a revelation for him and very healing for that partnership. It can also be the case that a particular partner's stage of development can have more to do with the overall stage of the relationship than just the life circumstances in which the relationship is anchored. When one of our partners is firmly grounded in a different stage of consciousness, their influence can have a profound effect not only on us as individuals, but also the relationship as a whole. This can be one of the most exciting and compelling aspects of a particular relationship, especially with a partner experiencing the self-authoring or self-transforming mind, because we can experience new levels of relational awareness that were previously unknown or unavailable to us. The exposure to the more expansive and creative aspects of these stages can be exhilarating and genuinely life-changing. Challenges, however, can arise when we find ourselves having to go back and forth between various stages as we engage in our different relationships, having to constantly adjust our relational experience to fit the parameters of contrasting emotional and intellectual environments can be confusing and disorienting and exhausting. Another way that discord between Keegan's stages can present itself is in situations where relationships themselves are presenting as being in different stages simultaneously. This is most common when couples have opened up their relationship, but for various reasons feel the need to continue appearing as a monogamous partnership to the outside world. Privately, Partners are consensually practicing non-monogamy, but socially they maintain the appearance of a monogamous couple. For some couples, straddling both worlds is not a problem, and they are able to navigate between their respective monogamous and non-monogamous identities with relative ease. But for others, the split in realities can create a tension that eventually becomes problematic, whether it is because one partner no longer wants to hide who they are, or because one or more of their other partners no longer wants to be kept a secret. The challenge of being in the non-monogamous closet can also become more challenging when couples struggle with conflict or have difficulties with jealousy. The need for secrecy and discretion means that people have very little, if any, emotional support from their social networks in times of duress. This can leave them feeling isolated and alone in their process and put even more pressure on the relationship. In situations like this, what I typically see is that individuals are either still very much anchored in the socialized stage but are wanting to move from monogamy to non-monogamy, or they are occupying an emerging self-authoring mind, but because of life circumstances, work, family of origin, religion, community, etc., they find themselves obliged to maintain the veneer of a socialized lifestyle. Deconstruction of the self. Up to this point, we have been getting familiar with Kagan's model of human psychological development, exploring the various stages and seeing how they apply to both the monogamous and non-monogamous experience. What we've seen so far is that as we move from the imperial mind towards the self-transforming stage, we begin to approach life and relationships more and more from the inside out instead of from the outside in. Simply satisfying our adolescent needs for instant gratification or making everyone else around us happy starts to take a back seat as we learn to follow our own inner guidance and allow more of our personal truth to come front and center. We have also seen that a monumental shift occurs when we begin to transition away from the socialized mind towards the self-authoring mind, which in turn initiates a powerful process of questioning the rules and expectations of our upbringing. We've also talked about how this shift can often leave us feeling more awake, alive, and aligned than ever before. And we've even gotten a glimpse of the profoundly expansive state that can accompany the final stage of self-transformation. However, there is still another side of this progression through Kagan's stages that is less glamorous. While we have already named several benefits that accompany the process of moving from one stage of development to another, we also need to acknowledge that for some, the transition into new and very different selves can be frightening, bewildering, and very destabilizing. As we move between the stages, our fundamental sense of self can undergo radical changes. Many of us are not prepared for this kind of internal upheaval, and it can feel as though the very existential tectonic plates of our being are moving beneath our feet. In the space that opens up between the previous and emergent stages, it is not uncommon to feel as though your fixed, reliable sense of self starts to fray at the edges and become unstable. As the familiar ideas and beliefs of earlier stages come more and more into question, you can face uncertainty that is often uncomfortable. The transitions between stages are incredibly vulnerable periods in our lives where deep insecurities and past traumas can bubble up to the surface, creating confusion as to what's up and what's down. I call this process the deconstruction of the self. As we progress through Kagan's stages, our susceptibility to this kind of self-deconstruction increases. Every time we transition from one stage to another, we must endure the nebulous space between them as we simultaneously let go of one while striving to integrate the other. When crossing this threshold from the old to the new, we cannot fully embrace or identify with either, and this can leave us feeling like we don't know who we really are. While this in-between place can have the promise of eventually leading to the reconstruction of a new, more expansive and integrated self, there can be a significant gap between the dissolution of the old and the emergence of the new that leaves people feeling afraid, anxious, and unwell. Often, the questioning that accompanies this gap is not limited to one particular area of one's life, but can fan out in multiple directions at once. For instance, challenging the constructs of monogamy could be just the beginning for some of a much greater, larger process of questioning all the other dominant paradigms, ideas, and discourses that have been deeply internalized around gender, sexuality, individualism, ownership, patriarchy, and colonialism. Or maybe your entry point into this process of deconstruction was something else, like your race, sexual orientation, or gender identity, and CNM was simply one of the paradigms that later emerged on your journey towards the next stage. Regardless of when CNM entered the picture for you, the process of pulling apart not only the essential building blocks of your personal identity, but also the very paradigmatic framework of your social reality can be genuinely terrifying and is an experience for which very few of us have any kind of precedent. It is also the case that for some people, the move from one stage to another can imply very real consequences, such as the loss of relationships with family or friends, negative consequences at work, loss of social status or legal rights, and even mental health issues. As I write this, I am reminded of a story told by one of my clients about her own process of deconstruction of the self. Through the process of opening her marriage, she was confronted with all the ways she had not been her own person. For decades, she had defined herself as a wife and mother, unconditionally supporting her husband's career, focusing on the kids, and investing her time and energy in the projects they shared as a couple. Her sense of safety and security, as well as her personal worth and value, came from being in a monogamous marriage. She even admitted that she had sublimated herself, given up many of her own professional hopes and dreams, just to be in that relationship. When she and her husband eventually opened up their marriage, she was completely unprepared for the ways it dismantled the entire foundation upon which she had built her personal identity. As she began to move forward with dating, she asked me, "What am I supposed to write on a dating profile about myself if my whole life has been about everyone else but me?" The subsequent vacuum left in the wake of that deconstruction sparked a grieving process that forced her to acknowledge the irrevocable loss of her monogamous identity and the fear of facing an uncertain future. Part of the challenge is that we can't just reconstruct our new non-monogamous self on top of the foundation of an old monogamous identity. All the old stories, tricks, strategies, masks, and defenses no longer fit. We have to recognize the ways we have been complicit with the narratives and beliefs that keep us small and disempowered, and we have to be willing to undergo a process of detoxing from the social constructs that limited our potential as dynamic and creative beings. Like the woman from the previous anecdote, sometimes we need to consciously grieve our past, holding space for all the ways we diminished or dismissed ourselves and our own needs just to be okay in relationships. We also need to be ready for the vacuum of meaning that can accompany the deconstruction process and learn to reframe this void as a creative space, rich with potential, instead of merely overwhelming or threatening.
Dave's deconstruction of the self. Over the years, I've had a healthy dose of experiences that have challenged my sense of self and initiated various processes of deconstruction. From very early on, I was exposed to racial violence and discrimination in the urban public schools of my youth. I've explored altered states of consciousness through years of psychedelic journeying. I've suffered two near-death experiences and have even endured a significant chronic illness since I was 19. All this to say, not someone who is wholly unfamiliar with the process of deconstructing and recreating the self. And yet, I have to admit, that even with everything I've just mentioned, I was not prepared for what I faced when Jessica and I first opened our marriage. I can vividly remember the searing anguish I felt in those first few weeks after opening up. As a couple who had maybe two or three explosive fights in the first decade we were together, all of a sudden we were now having arguments almost every other day. We were experiencing some of the hardest moments of our marriage, and I just couldn't stop my jealous outbursts. It felt like my life was breaking apart, and everything that mattered to me was slipping away. By the time I put my fist through a door for the second time, I realized something had to change. As someone who considered himself relatively self-aware, I was honestly shocked by the volatility of my reactions to Jessica dating other men. If she was intellectually or emotionally intimate with them, I was fine. But throw sex into the mix, and I became a fucking lunatic. I would have literal panic attacks when it was time for her to go on a date. And I would say to myself, this is crazy. I'm not the kind of guy who is possessive or gets jealous. I'm no slave to the patriarchy. Oh, how I was wrong. Through the madness of my primal attachment panic, I watched as the mechanisms of internalized patriarchy played out through the toxic narratives of masculinity that relentlessly ran through my anguished brain. This is destroying our family. If she loved me, she wouldn't be fucking some other guy. I'm worthless as a husband. All of the unconscious ideas about what it meant to be a monogamous husband and father of a nuclear family came rushing to the surface like rabid attack dogs. And in the worst moments, I couldn't even turn to her for comfort because, as far as my disorganized attachment was concerned, she was simultaneously the key master of my emotional well-being and the source of my torment. A huge part of what I was forced to come to terms with was the way that several unconscious ideas about sex and love had completely infiltrated my masculine identity. For one, I wasn't aware at that time that monogamy had instilled in me the idea that sex and love were inextricably fused. If there was sex, there was love, and vice versa. The merger of these two things in my mind gave each of them an inflated sense of importance that made it impossible to hold the nuances of different possibilities. For instance, I could not conceive of Jessica having a sexual relationship with someone else without that necessarily meaning she was completely in love with that person. I couldn't hold the possibility that maybe she was simply exploring her own sexual identity or wanting to expand her erotic experience through other connections without that implying she was in love with these other partners. And in the cases where she was feeling love for someone with whom she was having sex, the two-dimensional idea of love that still dominated my romantic operating system could not help but feel threatened by that. It felt as though whenever Jessica was having sex with another person, she was taking away love from me. Like mom, giving the boob to someone else, robbing me of my share of mother's precious milk. This is essentially why I melted down every time I had to confront the reality of Jessica being physical with someone else. I couldn't separate the two things in my mind. I couldn't hold the possibility that she could genuinely continue loving me to the same degree if she were giving love to someone else. In the heteromonogamous paradigm of my culture, the act of sex has long been considered the consummation of any legitimate or serious relationship. While it is much less common these days that couples will actually wait until marriage to start having sex, the singular and disproportionate importance we have awarded sex still lingers in the crawl spaces of our collective psyche. What complicated matters for me was the fact that Jessica's and my sexual relationship had been struggling during this phase of our marriage. While certainly not just a man's issue, I have seen in my work with partners a disproportionate number of men struggling with a similar dynamic. Because of society's influence, many men feel a profound disconnect with their own emotions, and the places where we are allowed to be genuinely vulnerable can be extremely limited. One of the few spaces where we can safely let down our guard is in the bedroom. This is why, for so many individuals, sex has taken on such huge significance. Aside from physical pleasure and intimate connection, it has also become one of the only safe places to be fully ourselves with our partners. This puts a tremendous amount of undue pressure on the sexual relationship, as it is required to serve not only as the release of sexual desire, but also as the emotional refuge for masculine angst. The trifecta in this recipe for disaster was, for me, the very unexpected influence of masculine narratives about competition and sexual performance. While I certainly remember being competitive with my brother around sports when we were kids, outside of that, competition was never really something that motivated me, especially not in the realm of personal relationships. As a husband in a monogamous marriage, I never had to face competition with other men. If men looked at Jessica while we were together, it was, if anything, flattering, because it simply meant that they recognized I was with a beautiful woman. At the end of the day, she was always going home with me. But after opening up, all that changed, and the interest of other men became a legitimate threat to my status as the most important man in Jessica's life. Or, so I thought. My identity as a more evolved or conscious man started to unravel as I found myself measuring my own self-worth in terms of how often she and I were having sex. If she had more sex with a partner in a week than she had had with me, I would interpret that as a sign not only that she loved me less, but also that my very integrity as a man was being called into question. I would wonder if he had had a bigger cock than me or was perhaps better in the sack. Was she with him because I wasn't man enough to give her what she actually needed sexually? Everything became a possible trigger for the masculine insecurities that, quite frankly, I assumed I had transcended long ago. It seemed like I was actually devolving as a person and becoming everything I'd worked so hard to let go of as a man in my culture. On top of navigating all the other challenges of opening up the marriage, which is already a big deal in and of itself, I now found myself dealing with the deconstruction of patriarchy, toxic masculinity, and my own self-worth as a man, as well as a ruthless, unrelenting attachment anxiety. The extremity of my situation created an almost desperate urgency to find out how to deal with this deconstruction of self. Jessica and I were in constant conflict. Things were slipping through the cracks at work. My relationship with my young son was suffering, and my emotional and physical health were declining rapidly. Without a clear path to follow, I was forced to improvise and try whatever seemed like it had the potential to help. The turning point came when I decided to go to Peru and participate in several ayahuasca ceremonies with a group that a close friend of mine had recommended. In the context of that shamanic work used in those ceremonies, I found a much-needed conceptual framework with which I could start making sense of my own journey. In the shamanic tradition, the metaphor of death is used to describe all the significant transitions that we experience as human beings, framing them as little deaths, or as the symbolic death of aspects of ourselves that no longer serve us. Like the caterpillar's transformation into a butterfly or the shedding of a snake's skin, we too continually pass from one self to another along a path of constant change and growth. Doing that work in Peru gave me a clear sense of the parts of myself that I needed to let go of in order to take the next step in my healing. While ayahuasca didn't actually take away the emotional pain of my experience, it did give me powerful insights into the specific narratives about monogamy and masculinity that were fueling my suffering. I was able to see how many of the ideas that I had internalized as a boy about what it meant to be a man and a husband were still influencing my sense of identity as an adult, and how most of those ideas were impeding my ability to give and receive the kind of intimacy I deeply longed for. I also realized that in order to really move forward in my process, I needed to let go of the idea that I had to handle everything on my own and accept that it was okay to ask for help. After returning to the States, I began a feverish search for the necessary resources and support, not only to continue navigating the deconstruction of my old self, but also to rebuild a new, more preferred self, one that was truly in alignment with the wants, needs, and values of the person I wanted to become. I did MDMA-assisted psychotherapy to heal anxious attachment wounds, used EMDR and somatic therapy to release trauma from the past, worked with traditional talk therapists to unpack the influences of my family of origin, joined men's groups to create circles of accountability, explored kink and sex positivity to reprogram my relationship to sex and intimacy, and continued engaging in new relationships to experience the different parts of me that had never truly integrated into the context of my marriage. Over time, I was gradually able to regain my confidence and began integrating all the different pieces of my process into a coherent narrative of what, for me, a healthy masculinity would look like. This new, more expansive vision of myself marked the end of a long and difficult process of deconstructing a self that was still partly anchored in the stages of imperial and socialized mind, and ushered in the emergence of the self-authoring stage. The point of my story is to highlight the ways that, for many, the process of deconstructing the self that accompanies the transition to CNM can be extremely difficult and painful. Instead of the expansive and awakening journey that some people experience, it can also be a harsh reflection of all the baggage of our monogamous, socialized self that still remains in the dark little corners of our minds. While your triggers may look different than mine, deconstruction is the same process of peeling back the layers of our identities to see how the social narratives about sex, possessiveness, purity culture, race, gender roles, and control continue to inhibit the free expression of our preferred selves. In order to cross the threshold of the self-authoring stage and experience the freedom that comes with it, we must first peek into our own shadows and recognize the parts of ourselves that still cling to the structures of repression and conformity. Choosing CNM is a choice to seek personal growth through the path of multiple loves. However, this path can break your heart wide open and expose you to the ways you have been out of alignment with who you really want to be. The invitation that lies just beneath the pain is to use this shattering as a powerful catalyst for creating a more awake, relationally fulfilled, integrated, and expansive you.
Chapter Conclusion. By applying Keegan's model of human psychological development to both the transitions from monogamy to non-monogamy and those within pre-existing CNM relationships, we are presented with a new way to think about the challenges that arise in these transitions. In the journey from the socialized to the self-authoring and self-transforming mind, we have the opportunity to let go of the socialized mind's tendencies to model our sense of self according to limiting social norms and expectations, and to gradually shift our inner compass towards the true north of our most preferred and authentic self. In the context of CNM, this journey through the stages promises deep personal growth and learning as we navigate the complexities of multiple relationships. As we learn to trust more and more in our own experiences and intuition, eventually we can have an awakening of the self, a state of conscious connection with the authentic self that emerges in the stage of the self-transforming mind, characterized by immense freedom and expansiveness. However, in contrast to the beauty and freedom that some people experience through the awakening of the self, the journey through Keegan's stages can also create quite an opposite experience. As we move through the various stages, the transitions themselves can have a very destabilizing effect on our sense of identity. This destabilizing effect is often accompanied by an acute period in which various fundamental aspects of ourselves are called into question, and we struggle to find a clear and safe sense of center within our own being. This deconstruction of the self can be a terrifying and painful counterpoint to the awakening of the self, even though they both share the same underlying capacity to provoke tremendous self-growth and inner transformation.